This Radio Days Africa audio amplified podcast is brought to you by the Wits Radio Academy. For more content and information, click to radiodaysafrica.co.za. 3, 2, 1. This is Radio Days Africa 2021. Audio amplified. Download the Radio Days Africa app. Search Radio Days Africa in your app store.
Hello to you and welcome to Radio Days Africa 2021. My name is Nelly and I'm your moderator for this session. This is the 12th edition of Radio Days Africa and the second time that it's virtual. This conference stimulates learning, engagement and conversation around radio and audio business in Africa. RDA is presented to you by the Wits Radio Academy under the Department of Journalism. And this year, Radio Days Africa hosts about 70 speakers in over 21 sessions. And you can download the Radio Days Africa app simply by searching for Radio Days Africa in the Play and App Store. All our sessions are podcasted and they're available to you on www.radiodaysafrica.co.za. Radio Days Africa has commissioned a bespoke podcast series. It's titled Podcasting the African Way. It's available from the RDA website and the sponsors. Radio Days Africa is sponsored by the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Media Program, Sub-Saharan Africa, who have been a long-term partner and sponsor, without whom Radio Days Africa would not be possible. Radio Days Africa is also supported by the National Association of Broadcasters, Media Heads 360, Wise Buddha Jingles, the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria, RCS Sound Software, Iono FM, Samro, and podnews.net. I'm glad you can join us wherever you are. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for joining us live. And remember, you can also listen to this even after it's done on the website and, of course, download the app. And I'm in Lagos, Nigeria. I'm here for this session, Beyond Fake News. The COVID-19 pandemic is taking fake news way beyond borders. It's spread faster than the virus. And in some instances, the disinformation is fueled by the over-enthusiastic online world and sometimes by the goodwill of people around us who love us so much and want to keep us protected from the virus. And so disinformation spreads with all good and bad intentions. In this session, we look at the trends, the practices and solutions that can keep us, that can keep credible news closer to us and also keep the audience aware of the news that they consume in these times. I'm joined by Mariana Springer, BBC's disinformation specialist. Her job keeps her fighting disinformation around elections, Brexit, COVID-19 on all social media platforms. Also joining us is Peter Mwai, a senior correspondent and fact-checking journalist with the BBC Reality Check. He's joining us from Kenya, and his fact checks and investigations cover misinformation in Eastern and Southern Africa on security, politics, and COVID-19. Earlier on, I had a chat with Mariana about her job and what the future holds for the fight against disinformation. We'll share that with you first and then continue live with Peter. So please go ahead and leave any questions you may have for our guests in the chat box. But for now, this is Mariana Springer.
Specialist disinformation and social media reporter, acting on the real world impact for the BBC. During the pandemic and conspiracies being shared on social media, innocent messages claiming that tanks were on the streets or suggesting that you can hold your breath to test if you have COVID, not helpful, could put people in harm's way, but often sent by people who just want to help their friends and family. Those have soon spiraled into very sinister conspiracy theories suggesting that vaccines are a way to microchip people or to commit genocides to kill loads of people. There's no evidence to support those ideas, or the suggestion that the pandemic just isn't real, that it doesn't matter. I spent a lot of time speaking to the people who've been impacted by this stuff, and it's absolutely been a global phenomenon. We've seen how the internet has no borders, and so disinformation will very quickly spread from one language to another and from one country to another. There are people who have had their relationships destroyed, people who have come to harm. There was one man in the USA who I interviewed who thought coronavirus wasn't that serious, that it wasn't real. He was reading posts on Facebook suggesting falsely that COVID was linked to 5G technology. He and his wife didn't follow health guidance. They didn't seek help when they fell ill. And really, really sadly, they both ended up in hospital and his wife later died from complications related to COVID. Other stories have involved violence inspired by disinformation and conspiracies. We've seen that happen in India. We've seen that happen in the US around the election. So this very much is something that we're experiencing and seeing happen in people's day-to-day lives. A number of stories have gone viral in Africa as well, particularly around anti-vaccine conspiracies. And a number of researchers we work with at BBC Monitoring in our disinformation team at the BBC have investigated claims about Mark of the Beast or use of Christian imagery in conspiracies that suggest vaccines could cause deliberate harm to people without the evidence to support them. And we see how these go really viral on platforms like Facebook and Instagram, but also in WhatsApp groups. And those are especially hard for us to investigate because WhatsApp is closed. We can't access the groups and places where this stuff is spreading in the same way. And we're really reliant on people from all over the world getting in touch with us so that we can investigate the stories that are being shared. Part of the work I do, as well as covering the real world impacts, the human cost of disinformation, is also about social media literacy, to speak to people about how they can spot conspiracies or falsehoods that are being shared on their social media feeds, and advice for people to talk to their friends and family who might be believing this stuff and might have been scared off a COVID jab by falsehoods that are unhelpful and lead them to make a misinformed decision. And a lot of that advice is to firstly, to question a post, where has this come from? Interrogate the source. Is this someone you can trust? And why or why not? Think about how something makes you feel. A lot of disinformation exploits pre-existing distrust, fears, and very legitimate concerns and questions that people might have in a bid to push false narratives. So really pause when you see something and think about the emotion that it evokes in you. And finally, just to do that, just to stop and think when you see anything. Don't compulsively share it. Don't just post it in your family group chat because you think it might be helpful. And I've really enjoyed that facet of my work as well, because it's meant talking to people all over the world about how they can spot fake news, myths, and everything else that's appearing in their social media feeds.
I know I've watched some of your interviews, and I've heard you say that it takes beyond fact checking and investigating disinformation to get people to actually, be purged of all of the information they've already absorbed and believed. I know you said at some point that it could probably take a campaign or something of that nature to do that. Have you ever thought about what this campaign could look like and if it will even be possible to do? And if you have, can you share it?
One thing that we find again and again is that fact-checking alone doesn't always work, because when people are presented with the evidence, they don't believe where it's coming from, they question it. And so there are other ways to try and question those people that have fallen for these often very extreme conspiracies, ask them why this would be possible. Why would anyone want to do this? What would you gain? And really interrogate it that way. Some of the most insightful advice on this that I've had was from interviewing a woman who used to believe this stuff. She used to be really deep into anti-vaccine conspiracies. She also thought the earth was flat and a lot of other really extreme beliefs that she'd come across on social media sites like YouTube. For her, it was very much about questioning the people who were pushing this kind of stuff to her online and really beginning to understand that perhaps their intentions weren't as pure as she might have thought at the beginning. So really beginning to interrogate her source and to do her own research, which is one of the favourite phrases used by people that often believe conspiracies. I think that in terms of broader policy points, one thing we see time and time again are relatives, friends, family members who get in touch with me and say, my mum or my cousin or my uncle is really believing this stuff and I don't know what to do. And sometimes they are so deep into these very extreme worldviews, it does feel impossible. No amount of good or accurate information will make a difference. I think that responsibility lies with the social media sites, who I spend a lot of time trying to hold accountable down to a duty of care, which there's pressure on the social media sites to honour when it comes to their users all over the world. There are also policy points and support programmes. A lot of people I speak to say that they would find it really helpful if they had resources they could access beyond the reporting I do, whether it's psychologists or experts in this field who can give them advice about how they can talk to the person they care about and how they can really help them and support them in this, what is not dissimilar to an almost de-radicalization process. And I think sometimes thinking about this in that way, most people don't fall so deep into these conspiracies that they have these very extreme views, but some people do. And it's not very different to when we've seen radicalization happen on the far right, on other extremes, religious radicalization. And so treating it in that way can be, I think, possibly quite a productive thing to do, as well as the different places taking responsibility to protect people on their platforms from seeing this stuff in the first place. Some of it boils down to something that's quite deep and quite difficult to address, which often is that people very legitimately are distrustful of systems and governments and authorities that have let them down, that they've experienced racism or they've grown up in poverty and they do not trust those systems, understandably so, because it leaves them very vulnerable to all of these conspiracies. And I think as well, when that issue is addressed, and that's a very difficult one that will take many, many years, then perhaps people may be less vulnerable to this stuff in the future.
How long do you think the damage that has been caused by disinformation and misinformation in all things, whether with vaccines, that's health, or politics with the elections and everything else, how long do you think this damage will take to truly be done with the world? Because, and is it discouraging when you think about it, that it could take years and decades and maybe an entire generation to truly fix this? Do you find it discouraging, and do you imagine how long it could take to truly, you know, get people back on track to trust, to know how to trust information and filter information? Because it doesn't look like social media is going anywhere. So they could do all that work, but the damage is done. And how long do we have to survive it to wean it off the system?
I think that's the most worrying part of my job, that I don't see any ready-made solution or that it's going to get much better anytime soon. In some ways, it feels a bit like a Pandora's box that is open, and it's really hard to put all of this stuff back in. I think if social media users were less exposed to this content, that would make a difference. But unfortunately, the drip, drip, drip of disinformation around the pandemic, also around elections, has absolutely seeped into the mentality of a lot of people. And this conspiratorial way of thinking is really pervasive, and it means that people are left vulnerable to even more extreme ideologies that they might come across on social media, on Telegram, on other messaging apps. I did a report recently which was all about what happens to the anti-lockdown movements that have sprung up all over the world when lockdowns end, because to most of us, you know, it would make sense that when there are no more restrictions, you don't need to protest on the streets anymore. Everything is hopefully sort of a bit more back to normal. But in interviewing people who attend these rallies, it became very clear to me that this is about much more than COVID-19. This was a deep belief that there is a very nefarious, sinister plot that is happening, which are worlds apart from political criticisms or other legitimate worries and concerns that people might have. And when you see it like that, that actually this is about more than the pandemic, this is very much a conspiracy worldview, it makes you very worried for other acts of violence like we saw at Capitol Hill that could happen all over the world. It makes you very worried for the approach to public health and other issues, which are obviously really high up the agenda in the years to come. And those mentalities don't go away very easily. There was a woman whose son I interviewed, and he was really worried because his mum has grown a huge following on social media by promoting myths about the pandemic. She was formerly a qualified nurse here in the UK. And it really stuck with me what he said, which was this pandemic will end and Well, hopefully it will end and everyone's lives will start to go back to normal. But the drama in my family rages on, and for mum, it will be something else. Looking forwards, we worry that a lot of the COVID conspiracy movements are turning their attention to climate change disinformation, and the idea that climate change is a hoax is part of a plan to restrict personal liberties. A lot of these conspiracy movements have also been co-opted by extreme groups, far-right groups, and groups on the far left as well. And here in the UK, we've seen a radicalisation to violence happening more and more, where people are angry, they're chasing after journalists and politicians, they're expressing that violence offline. So I'm really worried, both for the people that are deep into these conspiracy movements and for the others that could be drawn into them in future if they're not better protected from them.
Just recently, I finished some work around disinformation from religious leaders around COVID-19 vaccine here in Nigeria. And you were right, things about Mark of the Beast and all of that. And it's foundational. So all of these, you find that most of these claims and campaigns are actually quite, they connect with the audience because they can be foundational. So they find the root of your biases or the root of your beliefs, and then they spring from there. So it really is deep-rooted, and truly, as you said, life will go on, but these conspiracy theories and the theorists who believe them would need an outlet for what they feel. Now, I guess in the end, you cannot say knowing more about the news or being some way intelligent around information that you receive would help this, you know, because it's all rooted in bias. So I guess the question I'm asking now is, do you think that other than targeting particular people and particular regions or colonies of human beings, these, you know, campaigns, does it also just target the entire structure of communities? You know, and I know this answer could both be from your experience of watching how the networks move and flow. Does it sometimes, just for the sheer pleasure of it or whatever the reason is, target the core communities that we exist in? And when that community is broken down, a new one has to rise, which is total chaos.
You're completely right that in many ways, these conspiracy movements have become in themselves social structures, and they're often used to fill a void where there is a lack of community. We see quite a lot across the world, communities that perhaps used to have a town hall or a square where they'd gather and talk to everyone are now reliant on their WhatsApp groups or their local Facebook groups. And that absence of community, I think particularly during the pandemic, where a lot of people have been more isolated than ever before, has meant that these conspiracy movements have been able to fill a social gap as well. We've seen recently Telegram channels pop up, which are for entire communities for people who are unvaccinated to date one another or to live with one another because they don't want to live with someone who's had the vaccine. This has very much become about identity and about social identity as much as it is about the beliefs themselves. One thing I found from investigating the tactics of these conspiracy activists is also how effectively, as you point out, they deliberately exploit the Achilles heels of certain communities and seek to target communities where they think that they can best capitalize on that distrust. We've seen a lot of Black and South Asian communities here in the UK targeted again and again with anti-vaccine content that tells them that the vaccine contains meat, for example, or exploits a very deep distrust in the system here in the UK because they have legitimately experienced health inequality and racism. That means that they are naturally feeling perhaps a little bit more apprehensive about having that vaccine than other communities might. We've also seen how younger women have been targeted with conspiracies about fertility or the idea that the vaccine will somehow make you infertile. Again, deliberately trying to target communities that spend a lot of time on Instagram or other places who might be vulnerable to the tailored disinformation. And we've seen that in religious communities as well, happening all over the world, how this disinformation is tailored and targeted. And that is what makes it most effective. And it is also really worrying because broadly, most of people here in the UK or in Nigeria or all over the world will not be vulnerable to this stuff and they will not believe these conspiracies. But unfortunately, there are smaller communities and groups that will be more vulnerable to this stuff because it's designed for them to want to believe it or to be predisposed to believe it. And it leaves them very vulnerable. And I think if people can understand more about these tactics and how they deliberately target communities, that it's almost easier to protect yourself and to spot what's happening and how you might be being exploited or someone you care about might be being exploited. And in some ways, that is a bit of a shield, I hope. But it's a real worry. And I think absence of community is the perfect recipe. Absence of community combined with deep distrust or very legitimate concerns is the perfect recipe for a lot of these conspiracies to really, really spread.
I agree with you. And I like the mathematics right there, the little arithmetic, you know, the absence of community and actually quite sincere concerns they have for unanswered questions, you know, and then a lack of, you know, trust. All of that together is just perfect for these to, for this information to continue to thrive. But I guess like every communication and propaganda battle that has been fought for years in the world, it's slow, it's steady, but it'll take time, you know, probably take a generation. And then everything adjusts again and we get ready for who knows when the next one will be. But thank you for your work, Mariana. And it's a very interesting work. It's very exhausting and frightening, too. I hope you've been safe and staying safe as well. So thank you for joining us in Radio Days Africa. And we hope someday we'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much, Nelly. I really appreciate it.
All right. All right. Thank you so much for Mariana for joining us and for you for standing by. I know we already have a question on the chat box. But before we start that, let's welcome Peter back in. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Nelly.
Hi. So I have some of these questions down for you already, but there's an interesting one in the chat. And I find myself, you know, leaning towards that. But I think what I'll do instead is ask you something from what Mariana just said. She said, so she laid down the simple math for us, saying the absence of community is one of the reasons fake news spreads. Do you think there's an absence of community in Africa? Because we like to pride ourselves that we are very communal people. We still know who our grandparents are and our great-grandparents are. And we know our villages is something we're proud of. However, there are online communities now where fake news spreads. My curiosity is this. If we were in our village, for instance, and someone started a rumor and there's no one to check that rumor to know if the rumor is true or false. And so the rumor spreads, right? And it continues. If the rumor was about Nelly's family being vampires or something, right? It's more likely if there's no one to check that rumor, people will come to my home with sticks and stones, you know, to have my family wiped out the surface of the earth. The same attitude, I think, follows online. So I go back to that question. Is there an absence of community or are rumors just fueled by small communities anyway?
Maybe the easiest way to look at it is the fact that you cannot really call it the lack of, the absence of communities. The communities are there, but more and more we are having communities that are sort of specialized. You come together because of a particular interest. And the same happens, for example, be it a WhatsApp group or a Facebook group, where you'll be pulled together by interests. And what happens is when you have people who have maybe the same set of beliefs or maybe the same qualities, it's a bit hard for someone to call out the other because maybe they are the same level. Let's assume, for example, if it's to do with internet literacy or health literacy, they will be at the same level. But what maybe the difference we can make with the previous societies is that the communities then would not be homogeneous. They would be heterogeneous. So like there'll be someone standing and saying, no, that's not true because I have seen this elsewhere. But then now this existence of homogeneous groups of people with similar interests, maybe that could be where the issue is coming from.
Okay. Now we'll take this question first. Let me just click on it and then I'll continue with, you know, my questions. All right, so this is from Metro from Garden Route in Western Cape and says, how do we go about eradicating the dangers of sensationalist media and fake news in a quest to reinforce a responsible or reputable media? So basically, how does reputable media, you know, get rid of sensationalist media? Will that ever happen? Yes. I think we've lived with sensationalist media for forever, but go ahead.
It's a battle. We cannot say that we can do away with that completely because we know even when before the internet era we still had that sensational journalism. But then what can happen is now that there are some things that can be done to reduce the impact, and part of that would be. Although not everyone will be in support of that, regulations where there should be regulations governing how how journalists and professionals are operating both offline and online. The second one would be like what social media companies have been trying to do, although they do receive a lot of flack because people see that as trying to regulate the space that is there. Because what happens is once the sensationalism, once that sensationalism gets to a particular level where it's causing harm, then these social media companies can come in and maybe pull down content or maybe issue warnings to the people behind that. But I think the key, the most important thing would be if it's people who are engaged in journalism the way we know it, be it citizen journalists or just mainstream journalists, training would help so that everyone knows what is expected of them and what kind of behavior that is expected, and the standards and the guidelines, like the threshold that they should have before maybe posting something, so that would make people, the practitioners, aware before they publish content, and also on the impact. But then the other thing that can also happen is offering training offering skills to media consumers, where I think that's what from Mariana's conversation, the campaigns where the government and other stakeholders can come in and sort of enhance media literacy and internet literacy among the public, so that when someone is consuming information, I normally see people who, for example, I will just quote for you that I saw this on Facebook, so they believe that just because something is existing on Facebook, it should be truthful. They don't know that everyone has the leeway to post anything they can on Facebook. So they sort of treat this social media space as if it's an established media house that is sharing out information. So media literacy would help because we always talk about, for example, how people could go about like checking information before sharing. But then if the people don't know that that what they are encountering could be false or could be harmful, they would not go to that step of trying to check whether it's true or not. Yes.
You know, I've had what shouldn't have been an argument, but turned out to be an argument on air, on radio, when a listener called in and said, I conducted a research on this issue. And I said, where did you search? He said, Facebook. I did my research on Facebook. And I'm trying to point out, you cannot. Facebook is not an authority on anything. But it also goes, it's also similar to people who want to be experts on radio when they call in. And then they assume the position of experts. But the difference is there's a moderator, there's the radio host or the person, you know, who is a mediator between, you know, the audience listening and, of course, this so-called expert on radio. So I guess perhaps what's missing is this interference, you know, between on social media, between the audience, the people who are receiving this news, and the fake news itself. And that's what fact checkers are doing. They're trying to interfere and replace, you know, be in the middle. But sometimes it's too late because you're now debunking something that's already festered. So yes. I want to talk to you about pre-bunking. And then I have something else. I would never forget this because you said, let's train journalists and train citizens journalists as well. I thought that was the difference here, that one person had training and the other didn't. But we'll get there in a moment. So, yes, you know, pre-bunking, the idea that you anticipate the fake news, you anticipate what's going to spread, you anticipate the bias, and then you debunk it before it's actually taking root. You've worked in Africa for so long. You're a fact checker here. You've been fighting disinformation here. Is that something you think we can all adopt? And you think it'll be successful here?
What normally happens is you can do that, but for example, internally there's always that question of by me debunking this and publicizing it, am I adding more credence to the fake to the false information, or has it gotten to a threshold where I can come in and warn people that look, this is not correct? Because for example, if someone was to post something and then it only has maybe about 10 shares or 20 shares, whereas you're a media house and you're reaching millions of people, by you working on a debunk on something that has only been shared by by 10 people, and maybe this thing did not have a potential to spread, you will in a way have assisted that person get the publicity that inadvertently you'd have contributed to that. So maybe what you can do is the pre-debunk can come in internally, where you are aware of something, you have flagged it, and then you monitor whether and then you check whether it has this potential of becoming viral, and then now you make the decision yourself. But then when you get to like picking up everything that is cropping up, there's that risk that I was talking about here.
So let's talk about that citizens journalist training thing you just suggested. I'm thinking the difference between a citizens journalist and you and I is the training. So to what degree do you gather a person who sees something on his WhatsApp thread or his Twitter feed and decides, hey, or walks on the road, who knows, you know, and sees the news and decides to share it? To what extent of training, or just educate me here, what kind of training is necessary for a citizens journalist?
When I'm talking about citizen journalists, there's what is taken to be citizen journalism, which is not really journalism, where someone just sees something and then they post. But then there are people who are in this job of like walking around and finding items that are newsworthy and posting, where at that point you sort of stop from being a normal internet user or social media user and lean towards blogging, where you're sort of updating your followers on what's going on. And at that point, that's when I feel that there needs to be training, because this person has already started operating like a media house. It's a blog, but you're no longer like a normal internet user who is just interested in following up what's going on around you.
All right. Okay, if you're just joining the link, this is Radio Days Africa, of course, and we're talking about fake news. I'm Nelly, and Peter is joining from Kenya. I'm here in Lagos, Nigeria, and we're trying to see beyond fake news, actually. We're talking about fake news and how far it's spreading, but I'm hoping in our conversation we can see a little bit past it. And that's why I was very excited when I saw, when I trolled you on Twitter and saw your repost on a BBC story about how far, you know, what's happening now in Tanzania after, you know, Magufuli's death. I mean, let's take a look at what's happening. He believed in herbal remedies. He believed in prayers and all of those, you know, to deal with COVID-19. But he's also a very influential person. He's left lots of believers behind who are still probably believing something that is truly not a cure, as yet at least, for COVID-19. We don't know tomorrow if you could pray it away, but we know for sure today that you can't. So tell me a little bit about that. What happens after the major influencer of disinformation or misinformation is gone, but the seed has been sown? Tell me about that.
Yes, I would say that is the harmful effect of what goes on innocently, and it's not in Tanzania only, because when you look at the continent itself, we also have a lot of religious leaders who are spreading these conspiracy theories. Absolutely. And this makes it very hard for health authorities and for people who are trying to help for them to be successful. For Tanzania specifically, when you look at it, it was not there was the president Magufuli, but then there were people below him. There were religious leaders and there were also politicians who had bought into that. So part of the reason why things have not changed that much is because you still have people who some people who are left who are still there, and they still believe in some of these things. So it's a dilemma that is there.
And that's the spiral of fake news. You know, it just keeps taking root, and it doesn't matter if the person who started the spread has suddenly changed his mind or her mind. People believe it based on their bias. So for that reason, I want to ask this. How do you fix the bias? You know, fake news breeds on bias. But how do you fix it? Do we unbias the audience first, or do we let the investigation do the work? What do you think?
It's more of it's letting the investigation do its work. You don't, because for example, if a particular belief or conspiracy is being driven by religion, for example, you cannot go targeting religion. You'll target the misinformation itself, the claim, and try and debunk it and leave it at that. Because when you cross the border, then you'll get into a world where you're not it'll be a confused. You'll not win that battle. Because this is something that is that people have decided to believe in. But then for this a specific item, and where, because this is where fact checking and debunking becomes complicated, in that for you to say something is not true or there's no evidence, like you need to have evidence. So you cannot go disproving something just because you think that it's not true. But without evidence, you need the evidence, and you need to explain why you're saying that something is not true or something is wrong.
We have another question, Peter, and I'm just going to read it out to you. Okay. Now, it says, what can be done when certain fake or false information goes viral, that even if you do your best as a journalist to debunk it, the damage would have been done? When, where does the journalist stand in this scenario? So basically, where do you stand when the damage has been done after debunking?
Yes, at that point, it's tricky, but I would say there's only as much as you can do. You can only debunk and publicize your fact check, but there's no way that you can go. For example, remedying a situation if something has already happened. I know the challenge that we have been facing as fact checkers is that I know there's that saying that a lie travels I don't know how many times around the world. As in, this misinformation will travel many times faster than your fact check. Mm-hmm. And it will not a piece of misinformation might go viral, but then your fact check will not go viral. And I think that's where, at that point, that's where these other players come in. For example, social media companies and governments, where maybe if something has gone way beyond what is acceptable and it's causing actual harm, then the social media companies come in and pull down the content.
You know, I've been in a conversation where it was about how to make fact checks and digital investigations as interesting as the claims themselves, because that's one of the reasons it doesn't go viral. I mean, this is a fact. This is what it is. And I'm telling you that I can't sensationalize it, because then I could run the risk of lying about it to make you interested in it. No, but if it's a lie, I can spin all the webs that I want. I could spin anything I want. I just make it more interesting for you to digest, but not the fact. But at the core, I think, especially for radio broadcasters, I think in the end, journalism is storytelling, and we should be able to master that no matter what the conversation we're having is. So when I had to work on a podcast around COVID-19, I chose a podcast as the format, because I thought storytelling makes it a lot easier to swallow. You know, it's like medicine and a spoonful of honey or sugar or something. So I want to ask if you think that storytelling, or wrapping the facts around, you know, storytelling, making it a lot more interesting to listen to, do you think it dilutes the facts?
Not really, as long as you don't go overboard.
What's overboard?
For your content to be consumed well. Overboard is what you're talking about. For example, adding some other information just to make it sensational, as in and for example, when you're doing that, there's also this other element of what we call clickbaiting if it's online. Yeah. Like there are people who will put very very captivating headlines to their to their piece. But then when you click on it, you find that it's a totally different story, or it's a totally different narrative. When you try to do that, then you'll be going. I would say you'd be going overboard. You still need to stick to the code and conduct of journalism. You need to be ethical. But then what you're talking about improving our storytelling, this one doesn't apply to fact checks alone. It also applies to all these other kind of content that we produce. But within fact checking, what I would say is media houses and other bodies involved need to invest more in that, where you have resources allocated to fact checking, where if it's your fact checking journalist who is working on something, they have ample time and they have ample support. And then when for example you work on a fact checking piece, like you have support from social media teams. It's well promoted and it's well amplified. Instead of just, because for example you can work on a very interesting piece, but then it doesn't get any promotion on your media house's social media platforms, which means that it doesn't have any possibility of traveling.
Yeah. And then that also means, of course, nobody's seeing it, nobody's reading it, and it's not doing the job anyway. So do you imagine a time when you wouldn't need to fact check anything? Do you think there'll ever be that time? Now, I want you to take your mind as far and wide as you possibly can. Maybe not in our lifetime, okay? But yes. Do you think if you lived in an era where you never had to do actual fact-checking, because my next question is going to be about your frustrations with the job, which yes. exists. Yeah. So can you imagine one? And what do you think your role would be in such a world?
Okay, it's so hard to imagine. I think where our world has gotten to, it's very hard to imagine a world where misinformation is no longer a problem. Because as long as human beings are there, and as long as the internet is there, and as long as there's social media, people will still be sharing misinformation. So within that, it's very hard to imagine like what could be happening. But then I would say that what has happened with fact checking is it's not that it was not there before. It was there, but then it was embedded in other departments within media houses. For example, people who are doing investigative work, they were doing some elements of fact checking. People who, even when you're working on a story and you go out and you gather information, before you decide on what to publish, you verify the information. And that was some element of fact checking. So, to answer you, even if, in a way, misinformation as we know it now ceases to exist, that the work of checking facts, would still exist within media houses, if media houses are
still there. The fact checker will never be out of a job then. That's simply what it is. The fact checker will keep working.
For now,
That's good news. Definitely. It's so much better news than I heard yesterday. Okay. Now, Mariana said something about climate change. She said most of the conspiracy theories that have fueled COVID-19 and that have also, fueled Brexit and US elections and all of that have directed their energy towards climate change. And she believes it's going to get worse. There'll be more conspiracy theories. While she was speaking, I thought about Africa, and you can see what we're suffering with droughts, the Lake Chad Basin receding every time. There's barely food. People are hungry, and you see that people are more likely to believe climate change from the seasons are not the way we grew up anymore. I mean, you could tell how long a season would be and how heavy it would be. It's changed now. You know, so do you think every conspiracy theory that exists can travel? I mean, COVID-19 made it look like conspiracy theories were boundless and borderless. But do you think every conspiracy theory has the potential to travel from society to society?
It normally depends on because we normally talk about what normally drives these conspiracy theories. The people who are in it for because they want to make money or because they want to have influence on over people. So I would not say that every conspiracy theory has potential to spread everywhere, mainly because it will depend on what the conspiracy theory itself is about, and what is the agenda behind that. But when you come to something like climate change, like what you are talking about, because it's something that is at the heart and affects most people, it's very easy for these theories to take root in everywhere on the world if it's about climate changing.
So it's very likely to spread, because it might not be the same issue that spreads. You know, it might not be the same exact theory that spreads. Sometimes it's not the sometimes it's the premise of the theory that spreads. Actually,
yes, or the theory itself with some modifications. I saw that with COVID, with COVID-19, where, for example, something would originate from a particular a separate part of a different part of the world, and then by the time it's getting to another to the other corner of the world, it has gone through some modifications. I don't know. For example, there was one where you find like people just lift some fake news from a particular language, quickly go through Google Translate, and then it's localized, and then it spreads. Yeah, that does happen.
Yeah, that does happen. And also something else that happens that's also being discussed is the idea that half of these conspiracy theories do not actually originate from Africa. They come into Africa and then they take root. Now, I believe that the reason this is possible is because we already have these innate biases that allow it to happen. You know, I mean, you said earlier that you stay away from, for instance, if it's a religious theory, you stay away from the religion itself. You just fact check the idea of it, you know, the major claim itself. And I think that's also what any fact checker, you know, is trained to do. They'll say, find out the claim, bring it out, debunk that claim, and just let the rest, you know, disappear with time. I guess what I want to ask is if you believe it, that some of these claims, and I know this is a personal question and journalists don't like to share personal views, but this is a conversation beyond fake news. So do you believe it, that majority of these claims, these conspiracy theories, especially for COVID-19, come from outside of Africa and take root here?
There's some that come from outside. For example, the 5G conspiracy, that one definitely originated from outside the continent and then came and took root. And then there was the other one on, but this one was building on already existing conspiracy theories about that there's a group of people who want to set to create a new world order, and so this is part of all this. But then there's some, and then the other one connected to that is the conspiracies about Bill Gates and the rest. But then a theory like depopulating Africa, that one, in a way, it comes from outside. But then it also, there are some elements that come from inside, from within the continent. That it's more of. Within the continent than the elements that we get from outside. When you compare that to theories like the 5G and the other thing.
So I know I asked earlier about trying to unbias the audience, but I want to take a moment now and critique the advice we always give, the for now the instructions we would share to try to limit the spread of fake news. Pause before you share it. Ask yourself a question before you share, especially on WhatsApp. When it's been forwarded several times, it's most likely, you know, to be false. Before you share to your loved ones, ask yourself, why do I believe this? Or the reason I want us to critique those steps, even though we will still keep talking about them, this is not to say that those steps aren't credible or helpful. It's just to look at to look at our humanity and how human beings process information and see if we should keep modifying these advices as we go. Because is it really feasible that billions of people in the world would pause, take a look at information, wonder about it, question their biases before they share this information? In today's fast-paced social media world, Is that really truly feasible?
I would say it's feasible in a way. Although what everyone is trying to do is to, like, okay, we know the world has, okay, basically the world is moving, things are moving so fast. So we're just trying to, like, to tell people to slow down a bit. Like, don't be in a hurry to share information. And I think, it's the same thing with posting on social media, where we normally tell people, like, don't post something in case if you're not sure about. The same thing because we had talked about communities, in the villages, a rumor that you have not substantiated, you don't go spreading it in the whole village that, oh, I had so and so has done this, as you would want to hear it from two or three people to verify, to see it yourself.
Some people spread it.
Yeah, but then you become the rumor monger. And that's why we have this title of rumor mongers in the villages, because there are few. So, what should happen is, we should not become the rumor mongers on WhatsApp or on Telegram or on whatever social media platform we are operating. We should still retain those qualities of a normal villager and make sure that we verify what we are sharing before we share. It's more it's a battle, because, like I was saying, that social media has taught us to move on so quickly. So we sort of get that urge to share this, and then there's sort of some excitement that you have found this wonderful information and you want to share it with your friends. But then, as Mariana was saying, that some of this content you can always tell, because the moment something excites you or generates a particular emotion, there's more likelihood that there's something wrong with it, as opposed to something that doesn't have any emotions. Doesn't generate any emotions in you. Yeah.
Maybe social media just brings out the inner rumor monger in all of us, because now there's no one to shame you. So you might as well. I need to know, Peter, share with us your frustrations as a fact checker, as someone who is constantly fighting disinformation every day. It's your job. You wake up with some of them are just so impossible to look at. You know, some of them are so unhealthy for your mind. And I know this, you know. So how do you deal with it? First, what are your frustrations? And then how do you deal with it?
Yes, the frustrations are many. One is, okay, there's of course, the first one where, for example, you know you have debunked something, but then you find that it's still circulating. So, you wonder, okay, was my work in vain? Yeah, there is that. And then there's this other element of... although we normally talk about fact checking, it's not everything that is that you're able to check or to prove that it's not true or where it comes from, and that's also part of the frustration that we go through. For example, it might happen that maybe and sometimes you'll have this you'll have some clues that this thing is not what it's being purported to be. But then you cannot prove, like, for example, if it's a video, you cannot prove where, you can't really tell where it's coming from, no matter how hard you try. So that's one problem. But for that, because you're talking about, like, how we deal with it, is, I normally don't really count how many items I've failed to debunk. I derive the satisfaction from what I have debunked. And then the other one that you're talking about is where sometimes you deal with very uncomfortable content. Maybe they're videos or images that are very graphic or very very disgusting. For that, it's more of through counseling. You can go through counseling. But then on top of that is not being too much attached to what you are going through, even now and then, because if you immerse yourself so much into it, then it will have an impact on you. And then although this one also applies to everyone who is on social media, taking breaks also helps. If you spend maybe if it's a weekend, if you are off work, or if you you have been so busy, taking some time off social media maybe even if it's a day, you come back refreshed.
Yeah, I agree. Take a step back sometimes. I mean,
yes,
you don't need every information now, do you? Thank you so much, Peter. It's been wonderful talking to you. I've had a really good time, and I hope everyone who's watching, who's joined us, and who will watch this even much later, you know, would also have had a really good time. Is there anything you'd like us to know before you go? Any information you'd like to share with us? Maybe something you're working on personally.
Okay. In terms of working on, I think everyone has been seeing what's going on in South Africa. So, and I think the same thing, I normally prefer ending my conversations with when you see content that that looks too good to be true, most likely it's not true. So even for South Africa, there's a lot of content that is circulating that's true, that is from the current events. But then there's also some people who are taking advantage and spreading content that is not related to that. So even when you're consuming content from South Africa or wherever, even if it's your country, take a step back. As Mariana was saying, check who's sharing this information. Is he someone who is credible? Can I find this information elsewhere? Also check what media houses are publishing. Because for example, if it's something that's so big, that would excite your emotions and that would be newsworthy, you would expect that media houses have already picked that up. So there could be information that you get from media houses. And then also check what fact-checking organizations have posted, because some of the content has already been debunked. So and it would also appear foolish for you like sharing something believing that it's true, whereas someone else has already said that it's not true. So make use of that. And then when you get to the fact-checking organization's websites, also, if you have time, most of them normally have tutorials and some skills on how to do basic verification of content. So make use of that, and it will be helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you. I guess that's it. That's where we wrap up. Radio Days Africa is still going on until the 16th. It's about two more days and at least two sessions a day. So you can join them. Go on the website, www.radiodaysafrica.co.za.
That was a Radio Days Africa audio amplified podcast brought to you by the Wits Radio Academy. For more information and podcasts, click to radiodaysafrica.co.za.